When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I'm with Eric and Ted. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent.
Good.
Perfect. So the reason why I asked you guys to come on is I would like to know about P. Raboa. I've heard a lot about Raboa to begin with. And since your guys' company is actually producing the catheter, why not just go straight to the source, right? So since we're going to kick this off, Eric, if you would, please do a quick introduction of yourself.
Sure. My name's Eric. I'm a former Marine Corps corpsman. I did some reconnaissance work as well. I got my nursing degree. I commissioned in the Army as a nurse, and then I transferred to civil affairs officer. I've been doing the trauma thing for just about 25 years, and I work at Prytime Medical as the military clinical education manager.
Perfect. Ted, how about you?
Hi, good morning. My name's Ted Braun. I'm a former Marine Corps corpsman, now currently a National Guard flight medic, about 20 or 30 years of experience in the pre-hospital and tactical arena, everything from ground EMS all the way to critical care and flight.
Perfect. And how long have you guys worked at Prytime on this particular project?
This project, we've been doing this particular thing since the beginning of this year.
Okay. Ted?
Yeah. Same? I've been at Prytime since August of 2022.
All right. Nice. So this is relatively new. You guys took this over to Ukraine to train some of their medical personnel. Can you kind of walk me through that? What was the training? Who was present?
Sure. As far as I go, my team has been over there for over just about 2 months total, 7 different trips. And the training, we go to their location, whichever units we are training, and it's usually their surgical teams to include emergency surgeons, some medics, nurses, surgical techs, although I don't believe they call them surgical techs. And the training consists of a slide presentation, so some didactic stuff. And then that usually takes maybe 15 minutes. And then the rest of the time, we do pretty thorough one-on-one training. We usually have two simulation devices there that we're able to train with. And we will go as deep as they need to go to where they're able to teach it back to us. They're able to understand the patient population they're putting this in and able to confidently perform the procedure. We also bring physicians as well. So it's not just me by myself. It has been, but most of the time we bring a physician from the States that is very well versed in Raboa and the procedure to run that other simulator to be able to make sure we get the most effect for them. And it's all humanitarian work that we've done over there.
Yeah. I guess how many reps does a student get?
As many as they need. Okay. depends on their level, right? So the medics, will let them run through it because I personally think it's very important for them to be able to understand the procedure. So that way when it's happening, they understand what they need to do. Cause they over there, they do it a bit differently than we do it in the States, obviously for lack of some supplies or, the amount of supplies that they have to actually utilize. So medics will get a little bit of training on it. They'll run through it. They'll get the whole catheter brief and they'll be able to practice. Usually it's not a ton of training that they want or need. And then the surgeons and the anesthesia providers, those are the ones, they're usually teamed up together. And they're the ones that really will do a deep dive with. I mean, I've spent, you know, 3-4 hours with a few surgeons and anesthesiologists that I knew were going to use the catheter. And yeah, it's been great. I mean, their success rate is, it's great.
All right. Perfect. Perfect. So they go through the training. Is there any kind of sustainment plan, in place already? How frequently would that be?
So how frequently would I like it to be? I'd like it to be an every 2 to 3 month thing. Operationally, it's been, I would say we've broken those trips up, about that much, to include the 7 trips. And any questions that they have or any complications, that they can think of as far as after the training, not necessarily complications, but, you know, they do the training and then they go back to their unit and they're like, oh, I wish I would ask that question. They all have me on Signal. I do telemedicine consults with them in case they have questions. And they also, we're in contact frequently. I would say probably every other day I get a text from at least one of the people that I've trained or one of the teams. And they update me on, you know, like what they've done, if they've used any, how the procedure went, patient outcomes, pretty detailed. And so I'd say the sustainment that I'd like to see is, every 3 months. I would say that same for stateside also. Just over there, it's a little bit difficult to be able to do it every 3 months.
Yeah, absolutely. That pesky thing called war happens and exactly. It throws everything off. So perfect. So obviously the training was successful and their capabilities are increased, and that's always good, right? Now, if we could start going into the actual P-Reboa catheter, like I said, I'm a little bit familiar with the original Reboa catheter. What are the differences between these two things?
So I'll tell you, there's 3 different versions of the device. Right? The first one that came out was called the ER Reboa. It's very much a parallel upgrade to the ER Reboa Plus, which is what the military is accustomed to seeing right now, the U.S. military, well, really all NATO military. And the difference between those two are very slim. There's a couple markings that are different, and there's also a tag that they added to be able to write when the balloon goes up and blood pressures and things like that. The real difference is when you get into the P-Reboa, and P stands for partial. The catheters look the same at first look, but once you actually hold them in your hand, you will see that the catheter itself, the balloon port, has a safety valve on it. It will not allow you to inflate the catheter too fast or too much. It just kind of blows off the saline. And the balloon itself, the older balloon, the ER Reboa and the ER Reboa Plus were compliant balloons, meaning they just filled whatever space you put them in. These ones are semi-compliant. They are a different material, and they have these ridges on them. And the ridges allow for blood to go past the balloon while still occluding enough to increase the patient's stability threshold. So that's the big difference, that you still are able to get the patient stable enough as well as still maintain some type of perfusion below the balloon, which you couldn't technically do that with the first iteration.
Okay. So, you know, the original Reboa inflation times were very limited, and at least in the austere environment, it made it almost impractical. When you're talking about zone one, you know, just above the diaphragm, 30 minutes. I'm barely getting done with my telemedicine call before within 30 minutes, let alone that and transport and getting them under the knife. You know, zone three, just below the kidneys there, you get about an hour, right? So what kind of balloon times can I get with this partial Reboa?
So the beauty of the partial Reboa, like I said, is that you still maintain some form of perfusion below the balloon. So those times of 30 and 60 minutes that you're getting with the plus balloon or even ER Reboa, they're able to be extended because you're able to continue having occlusion or partial occlusion below the balloon. And we have case studies that we've seen well over 2 hours. In the States, and which I'll let Ted talk about a little bit, and as well as in Ukraine.
Okay. So, Ted, you're the master of the numbers. So 2 hours is about as far as you've gone?
That's kind of the grouping of it, but we've actually gone upwards of that. We've gone upwards of 3 or 4 hours in zone one of partial occlusion. So it's definitely increasing our capabilities. And we've been able to do that on multiple occasions without a significant increase of kidney injury or ischemic insult.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Excellent. And obviously that was one of the major concerns with the original Reboa, is essentially you're cutting this person in half at the diaphragm, not perfusing anything below that. So let's just kind of compare and contrast the complications of it. Obviously, you know, with the original Reboa, you're not getting any perfusion whatsoever. So what were the complications of that?
The complications with the P Reboa, the concerns are all the same as just Reboa in general, because you're limiting blood flow past the balloon. But with the partial, we're able to kind of titrate it and everything else. But the concerns are still the same. What we're currently involved in a DOD-funded study that is measuring four specific things. It's measuring the time of occlusion, so the total length of occlusion. It's measuring the ischemic markers to see any kind of measurement of injury past time, tolerance to reperfusion, and blood product use. So those are the four. Those are the four main metrics that we're looking at with the DOD study. And so far, everything is it's very early in the study, but everything is still looking pretty promising right now.
Nice. So, I mean, I could see where the benefit of the original Reboa, you're stopping all blood flow, so obviously you're not bleeding through the injury anymore, right? You're perfusing the heart, the lungs, the brain. That's about it, though. So you're keeping them alive long enough to get them to surgery to fix the actual injury. So as far as blood product use, you pretty essentially stopped it once you got the upper half of their body resuscitated. Now with the partial Reboa, like, I guess, what amount of reduction in product use are you seeing? I don't know if that's making sense, but you're still going to have to use product. Obviously, it's going to be reduced.
Ted, I'll take this. So most of the surgeons in the States, that when they go to inflate the balloon, they go from almost like a wide open usage of products. So think MTP. As the balloon goes up, they significantly limit the amount that they actually need to maintain the patient's stability. Cause now you're almost using the balloon. You're titrating the balloon to the patient's perfusion metric that you want to see. You're not shooting blood into them to maintain the perfusion that you want to see. So by being able to do that and still maintaining the partial occlusion, which is maintaining flow below, you're able to significantly decrease the amount of blood products. That's one of the main things that we've seen at least that the surgeons tell us, is a benefit of the partial occlusion. I don't know, Ted, do you want to add to that?
No, it's definitely a benefit. Has been reduced blood product usage, better visibility once they get into the patient and they open the patient up. Now there's not a whole lot of blood filling up the cavity, and they can actually see the partial occlusion working because they can see that the organs are pink and not grayed out and not having issues. So there's definitely multiple benefits that they've observed: less blood use, less product use in general, better reperfusion once they come off the balloon, better ability to reperfuse without any kind of issues after that. Just a couple of the multiple improvements that they've noticed with this balloon.
Okay. Now, just back to just the blood products, and then I'd like to go over some of the reperfusion injury prevention things. So I imagine in Ukraine, same issues we have on and FSTs while we're deployed is amount of blood product. And, you know, you may have 10, 20 units. On one guy, you're okay, but you start getting multiple casualties, like that gets drained really quick, right? So in the case studies or the reports that you're getting from Ukraine, I'm guessing they also have a limited amount of blood product available. Are they, with just that limited amount, are they able to sustain a patient long enough to get them back to some kind of definitive surgical repair?
Absolutely. I couldn't tell you the exact number of cases that are done. I'd like to think it's probably well over 30. But I can tell you that I have pretty detailed knowledge of 10 of these cases. And every single one of the cases, except one that I don't have that much detail on, but I know the patient didn't make it. Actually, I have 11 cases now because I just got one yesterday. So 10 of these cases, the patient has come in a few times in arrest where instead of opening up and doing a thoracotomy like we would do in the States, they put the balloon up and were able to get ROSC, stabilize that patient, and then transport them out. They're literally coming through something called a stabilization point. Think of it as like a desert team. And they put the balloon in and they're able to transfer them to a more definitive care area. And they, in some of the reports, it does detail how much blood products they've used. I haven't seen any that have been over 2000 milliliters. So you got to think maybe three to four units of blood that they're actually having, and that's combined products. So plasma, blood, platelets. Some of the videos or telemedicine consults, you hear them in the background saying, okay, we've used up the blood products and now we have to do something else. So it's the same very real issue there, but they are able to use less blood products, whether they want to or not. They're able to use less blood products and still have a stable, critical but stable patient to transport to another surgeon to be able to have definitive hemorrhage control or definitive care.
Okay. So, I mean, 4 units, say that's the average. I mean, that's still pretty incredible considering the type of injury that's probably going to require something that, like a REBOA or P-REBOA. So let's talk about some of the reperfusion injury complications and things like that. So how are they monitoring for this? And what are they doing as far as treatments and maintaining that or holding back that ischemic injury?
So 2-part answer for you. I'll tell you what they're doing overseas, and then Ted can speak to what they're doing in the States. Okay. So overseas, most of these cases from 2 particular teams that I'm regularly in contact with, they utilize sodium bicarbonate. And they utilize calcium, and they like to utilize plasma when available. And that's what they're doing to really mitigate that reperfusion injury. And also using the partial occlusion is really what mitigates the likelihood, I'll say, of the reperfusion injury, because you're not stopping all flow. Even if you stop it for a little bit, most of the time you're opening that balloon back up and letting some flow through once you've kind of stabilized the patient. So I would say that's what they're doing over there. And you know, they have different times when they actually give that, whether it's when they take the balloon down or during the procedure. But that's what we're seeing over there that they're doing. And then Ted, you want to talk about the States?
Yeah, and stateside, it's a lot of it is just the same standard treatment for any kind of reperfusion injury in the past also. But like Eric said, with the partial, the beauty of the partial is that you're allowing blood flow to get past. So that in and of itself is cutting down on the potential for reperfusion injuries, because you're just constantly able to kind of circulate the blood and stop the buildup of those issues. So that's the biggest thing. And if they start to see any issues, then like Eric said, bicarb, calcium, the common standard practice for it. But the beauty is with the partial occlusion.
Right. No, that makes sense. I mean, are they watching the EKGs, or are they doing iStats, or all the above?
Yeah, they're doing all the above. They're watching the cardiac. They're watching the lab values. They're doing even after Reboa usage. They're doing your regular checkups, your Dopplers, your post 24s, things like that. So a lot of it is just the same standard practice that they're watching for and that they're keeping up with. But with the partial, okay, we're able to go,
I guess, kind of similar.
I was going to say one thing I will say as far as the usage is concerned in Ukraine, they don't have a lack of patient population to utilize. But right, like we stated with the blood products, they have a lack of product to be able to utilize on the patients. And we do our best to be able to get them product, but there's a lag time, obviously, as it has to go through a bunch of different hands before it actually gets to them. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, of course. You know, there's a lot of need all over the place. So being able to allocate resources is going to be difficult. It's difficult in the U.S. and we don't have a war going on here. What I was asking as far as, signs that they're looking for, would that be similar to like a crush type syndrome where you're seeing like the peak T waves and things like that? I guess I'd never seen ischemia on an EKG.
You'd be looking at hyperkalemia, increased lactic acid. And Ted, do you want to add to that?
That's typically what you're looking for, all that.
Okay. Now, I'd like to ask about placement of the catheter. So, from my end of the spectrum, lots of packing, junctional type tourniquets or things like that. Well, that's all occupying generally the space where you're trying to put this catheter. So how do you even begin to place this catheter when you have all my gauze, my ACE wrap, my pelvic binders, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how do you get this done?
So there is one case in particular, talking about not necessarily pelvic binder, which pelvic binder isn't really a contraindication. What I've seen in the States is they just cut and then they go right into that area. Like they just cut a piece, say a T-pod, they'll just cut a piece of it out and then put it in. But to your point, we can even add abdominal junctional tourniquet to that. And then I'll tell you about a case that patient came in peri-arrest. They had an abdominal tourniquet on, some other issues, obviously. Patient arrested in front of this particular team, and they did a quick fast on the patient, saw they had blood in the abdomen, put the Reboa, got access, put the Reboa up into zone one. And the way that you know you're in zone one quickly is because there's markings on the catheter itself that are predetermined where zone one and zone three are. And they put the catheter up, they blew the balloon up, took the abdominal tourniquet off, did one round of CPR and were able to get that patient back. So the interventions that you do don't necessarily get in the way of being able to do this at the right time. I could certainly see how it seems that they could. But I mean, that's what I would say on that. I mean, what do you think, Ted?
I agree. I think it's a lot of it is just concurrent treatment going on at the same time. But as far as access, it's just trying to work around it, because at the end of the day, you only need about a dime size or quarter size worth of space to get your vascular access. So whether it's cutting a hole out of the teapot or.
Okay. So you're going after that femoral triangle. Is that correct? Or are you going above?
Now you go above, you go to the common femoral artery. So where they come together, that triangle comes together a little bit above that is what you're doing or where you're accessing. And I would say, talking Ukraine now, 90% of the cases are done with bedside ultrasound or handheld, okay. I should say, not bedside.
Okay, perfect. So something like a butterfly or something like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Too easy. So we talked about the complications. Now, for your specific training in Ukraine, it seems like you're kind of targeting like the surgeons, anesthesia, or like the bread and butter of what you're going for. Obviously, you're training the support personnel around them so that at least they're aware of what's going on. But the bread and butter was the surgical side of things. Now, a layman such as myself was like, well, they're surgeons. Why are they doing the REBOA? Why don't they just fix the problem to begin with? So maybe some of that kind of resource intensive type procedure. Because I know one of the things that is going on our side is that they want to make these surgical teams smaller and smaller and smaller. And it seems like a good idea on paperwork, but that also reduces your capability over and over and over again. So I guess, I don't know why, why do they want to do REBOA versus just fix the actual problem, fix the vasculature directly?
I can talk about Ukraine side. Sure. The reason they're putting the catheter in, so they have these things called stabilization points. And that's exactly what they do there. They stabilize the patient as best they can, ship them to, say, an FST. That's not exact terminology, but I'm pulled a parallel. And some of these stabilization points at the height of things, they're seeing like 10 to 150 patients. Mm. And there's a couple docs there. One's anesthesia, one's an emergency surgeon. There's a couple nurses, a couple medics. There's a couple stretchers, there's like goats running around and whatnot. So the resource management in that area, and the time management in that area, they are only stabilizing and then shipping out as soon as they can. So that's why, at least in Ukraine, that's where I primarily see it getting put in. Have I seen it get it put in, later? Yes. But I'd say 90% of those cases are stabilization point driven.
Okay. So they just don't have the capability. They don't have enough hands to do the more definitive surgery where they are.
Correct.
So they're using this as a stopgap to get them farther up the line. Okay. So if it's, if it's good for the surgeon to do that, why can't I just start throwing them in my aid bag? And now I have two hands. I'm smart enough. Why can I not do this on the X?
Ted, do you want to take that one? I have opinions, but I'll let Ted go.
That's
first.
Okay. Go ahead and flame me.
You're on mute, buddy.
So this is where we kind of have to be careful regarding what we're commenting on versus opinion, because we both have experience on the military side, but we're also beholden to the company and to FDA regulations and things like that. I think the difficulties you would run into in that setting is going to kind of resort back to just level the training also, because you're talking about gaining vascular access, utilizing ultrasound, monitoring, doing pressure monitoring, and understanding the pressure monitoring and understanding all of those things and how they all fit together. So it gets kind of complicated with that. It's something that can be trained to. It's something that Eric trains to all the time with the groups he works with. It's something that I train to all the time when I'm working in the hospital stateside. The same way that Eric works with his groups in my hospitals, I work with the nurses, I work with the physicians, I work with anesthesia, with all of them, because it's kind of a team approach to it. As far as what's keeping you from putting it in your aid bag, I would say it's capabilities and protocols. I think that's probably about the best way that I can answer that.
Yeah. That's the nicest way. Yes.
Getting ourselves into trouble.
Yeah. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. I agree with everything Ted said. It's not necessarily a knowledge lacking situation. I'd say there's probably two main reasons why you're not putting it on the X. It'll be time. Time is probably the biggest one. And there's extracurricular activities happening around you that will also take up your time. So you're not really going to be able to set everything out. And I'm not saying you can't do it rapidly, but you wouldn't necessarily have the amount of time, hands, or safety to be able to just get it all done there. Yeah. And as far as putting it in your aid bag, the best example I can think of for that, as far as my experience goes, when my FST broke down into like two ghost FSTs and then further into a damage control resuscitation team where there's only five of us, that's a capability that we carried. And, you know, in those scenarios, your expectation for patient care, what you're supposed to be able to take care of, is very limited. Sometimes only two resuscitations or one massive surgery, which can, you know, put you dark real quick. It can be as we're seeing in the States, and also as we're seeing in Ukraine, it's a stopgap, as you stated. And it can buy you time to be able to get the definitive hemorrhage control you need. But on the X, I think I don't think we're there yet. I don't even want to say quite there yet. I don't think we're there yet. I think we have years and years before we get to that. But that's not saying that a couple of clicks away, you wouldn't be, you know, you'd have a D-cert team there and they'd be totally fine putting it in. I mean, Ted, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, because I think you're limited by your equipment. You're limited by, like you talked about, like having a butterfly, having a V-scan, understanding how to use all that. And just like Eric said, having the tactical time to be able to incorporate that, that's going to be your bigger challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I run into this issue all the time, is that medics see a new thing and don't get me wrong, there is an actual problem. Like when you're talking about, you know, junctional hemorrhage, you know, gunshot wound to the box, like that's a major problem. And we don't really have a great answer for that on the medic side. So the desire is, well, let me go find an answer and now I can be the savior of everyone. Medics forget, like, this is a portion of my job, is the actual medicine, right? I'm expected to carry ammo. I'm expected to be a warfighter. I'm expected to be a tactician, use a radio, like all these other things. And that's over and above what I'm supposed to remember, what my actual job is being a medic. And so the amount of training that I get just doing the medical part starts to fall by the wayside pretty quick when you talk about all the other things you have to be able to do. Now you throw on top of something that we already talked about. Ideally, every 3 months, you're going through another training cycle on this one procedure for a small amount of patients you're probably going to run into, the bang for the buck is probably not there, my opinion, at this moment in time. That's just the training side of it, let alone the resource side of it, where it's not as simple as, it's not a long IV catheter that you're sticking up into somebody's diaphragm and inflating it. Like, this is a bit more complicated with actual consequences if you screw it up. So that's why I asked you that question, because this is kind of a hot topic, and I know there's a lot of medics out there that are like, I'm going to go find me one, and I'm going to stick it in my bag, and I'll watch some YouTube videos, and I'll know how to do it. There is way more to it than that. And not only is it initial learning of that skill, it's actual sustainment of that skill. And those things are not cheap. So both money-wise and time-wise, being able to stay on top of this one procedure when you have many, many, many other procedures that are, I would say, a bigger bang for the buck, being able to be a master of. Again, just my opinion. When it comes to P. Reboa, I guess you've done your training cycles in Ukraine. I'm sure those things will continue at some pace. I guess, what are your plans going forward in the future?
As far as sustainment training for Ukraine?
Sustainment, or like, I guess, what's next? So you've done case studies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming randomized controlled trials, or do you want a little more definitive research being done on this?
Yeah, we're looking at all options to get more definitive research. Obviously, for the U.S. military, this is something that I personally think could benefit. Mm-hmm. So that is something that we're looking at all avenues to be able to get all the data collected and in some type of presentable format to be able to be useful. As Ted likes to say, a lot of this is anecdotal, although the data that is coming out of Ukraine, it is factual, but there's nothing controlled about it. So obviously we're always looking at ways to be able to change that.
Yeah, absolutely. Ted, any final thoughts?
Not really. No, I'm happy to be a part of this. I spent so many years at the bedside taking care of all these patients that you just had trouble doing these things and transporting these patients that were just, you go into a hospital or a facility and they give you a bag full of blood and say, here you go, good luck. And so I'm happy to kind of be a part of something that I really truly believe in, and that I think it's got a lot of promise and a lot of potential just in my own personal use with my job in the military and things like that.
Yeah. Actually, you reminded me something. So you mentioned, transporting with the P. Reboa, and it like blew people's minds. Like, how are they securing this in place? Are they just suturing it to the skin, or?
In Ukraine, they will use a 5 French catheter clamp and suturing it in most of the time. Sometimes they do skin staples.
Okay.
Stateside, Ted can speak to this. They use a 5 French catheter clamp that comes, because we have a convenience kit that comes with the catheter clamp and some sutures. And they'll use the sutures to be able to stabilize the catheter to where it doesn't come out. While they're not transporting in the States, they are putting it in the trauma bay and then going to other care areas to get more definitive idea of what's going on before they go to the OR.
Mm-hmm.
Draw the parallels as you wish, but so that's the way that they secure. Ted, is that accurate?
Yeah, it's accurate, because you have the catheter that goes in through a 7 French sheath, So you suture that in place, and then the catheter goes in through that. The Rebelle catheter goes in through that, and then that's secured with the securement clamp, like Eric said, and then that's sutured down. And then you'll have some surgeons. It's like anything else. You'll have some surgeons, oh, I'll do this too, or I'll do this. But that's the most common method.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, it's one thing to go from the ER to, you know, interventional radiology or go into the OR. You know, you're essentially just sliding around on a bed, and like the movement side to side is relatively minimal. Versus Ukraine, you're getting thrown into the back of an ambulance. You're bouncing across, pothole roads and bombed out roads, hard turns, going real fast to, you know, whatever definitive treatment is. So obviously, whatever securing method you have, it's going to have to be pretty robust because he's going to get bounced around a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're lucky if you're getting in an ambulance. That's majority of what I've seen is using the catheter clamp and suturing it in pretty decently, or skin staples. And it gets you the same bang for your buck, essentially. One takes just a tiny bit longer. I mean, the entire procedure itself is not difficult, right? It's gaining vascular access, putting a catheter in, blowing a balloon up. The intricacies are with the education that you have of where and what that's going to affect, how you can mitigate it, and then having a plan of who's going to actually fix what you're mitigating. And that's why to your initial or your question about putting it on the X, there's just a lot of other stuff going through your mind, not to mention all the other stuff we talked about. While the procedure and the muscle reps that you could get, or muscle memory reps you could get by doing sustainment training, I still don't think it's a X device yet. But you know, there are studies that are out that say the more you do something, the better you are at it. So
that's true. That's true. True. Cool. Well, do you guys have anything else you'd like us to know?
I mean, I'll plug the company just because.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So if anyone has any questions about this, I would direct them to the website first, prytimemedical.com at prytime, prytimemedical.com. If anyone has any, questions where they don't want, or they are not finding the answer, they can email me. It's EAKRISH@prytimemedical.com. And then we can continue the conversation there.
Okay. If I wanted training, and you guys are the only ones who can do it, how can I organize some kind of training?
Same way. You can email me, or you could, there's a inquiries tab on our website, that links to an email address. You could put all relevant information in there and we'll get back to you.
All right. Perfect. Well, thank you guys very much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That's it for today's podcast. Be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Every boy is waiting there for you.